This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and the book industry. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I'm talking to Steve Clay of Granary Books, and that's G-R-A-N-A-R-Y. For those of you who have not seen a granary in a long time, how are you, Steve?
I'm great. Thanks, David. Thanks really, for the invitation.
It's really good to have you here. You know, our paths have crossed many times over the, sometimes over the many years, but not recently.
And, it's been a while. Yeah, it's been a while.
It's good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you,
too. So, and a lot of things to talk about, but really want to ask you about Granary and, you know, kind of your, to start with, maybe give a little background and the history of, your history of what got you to become a publisher. Which is really, you know, what the, these conversations are about, but it's the literary world in general.
Yeah, that's it. You know, it's not something you plan. At least I didn't. I didn't come from a bookish home family.
Where are you from?
I'm originally from Northern Iowa, Mason City, Iowa, midway between Des Moines and Minneapolis, didn't really discover a lot of writers and so forth until I was maybe 21, 22.
In college or out of college?
I did two years of college as a draft deferment, and that was sort of an extension of high school, really. And then by 72 and 73, I started getting a little bit more serious about intellectual pursuits of that sort, and started to discover through Eastern philosophy, started to discover some of the poets that bled into, you know, things that had more to do with Eastern thought and meditation and things like that.
So you came to writing through...
through meditation.
Yeah,
I would say so. Yeah, I taught TM for a while. Mm-hmm. And oddly, some of the most brilliant people from my graduating class all went over and studied with the Maharishi in Europe, in Spain, in 72 or so.
This was before he started the center in Fairfield, Iowa.
It was. It was before that, yeah. And and I picked up on it through them sort of by accident. I knew these people, but they weren't part of my social group, you know, in high school. But a couple years later, they were giving a talk in Mason City, and I went to it, and it kind of floored me in a way, and I immediately started meditating, took on the practice, started meeting some of the people that were involved, went away, took some courses, and started being in contact with kind of a more civilized, socialized world than I'd been used to up to that point. And I have a vivid memory of kind of a doorway opening, a major doorway opening, when one of the guys, one of the TM teachers at the little TM house in town, came downstairs one day and said that he was a poet. And he just kind of casually mentioned that I'm a poet and I've finished writing a poem. I'd like to read it to you all. There were two or three of us sitting in the living room. And I was just floored. You know, I couldn't believe that somebody that I knew would claim to be a poet, whatever that meant, I didn't really know. But he proceeded to read a kind of a Duncan-esque, lengthy poem that I remember it had to do with falcons somehow. Maybe that was the Duncan connection that stuck with me. But he announced also that William Blake was his favorite poet. And so I immediately went over to the Mason City Public Library after that encounter and looked up Blake and started looking up some other references that he'd mentioned. Another was Nietzsche. And that together with some of the primary texts that were around the TM world, the Bhagavad Gita and some other things, were really a liftoff point. So started discovering other poets around that time.
But you eventually got to Iowa City, or did you? Did you live in Iowa City?
I lived in Iowa City. Let's see. I did, after a number of years teaching TM, I went to Iowa City for real to go to college in the sort of around 78. And so I was a religion major initially. I wanted to study Sanskrit. Never took a Sanskrit course in my whole time in college, but I did find my way to the English department. And that's when I really, really started absorbing and studying and exploring in writing and the history of literature and philosophy of writing and things like that.
And what got you to, I mean, this, I'm, there may not be a direct connection, but what got you to the kind of, the kinds of writers that you became interested in, like via, you know, let's say it's Black Mountain Beat poets, San Francisco poets, whatever you want to call them.
Yeah.
Language, I know you were interested in and close to a lot of the people like Charles Bernstein. How did you get from being in an English department at Iowa to, you know, kind of the more open field, let's call
it? Well, Iowa had much more going on than what people think it had going on, much more than I even realized at the time that I went there. When I went, I had visions of Ted Berrigan, Anselm Hallo, and some of those people who had taught there recently. I didn't know then that others like Michael Lally, George Matting, Lee Barrett Wotton, Robert Grenier, Bob Perlman, Alice Notley, all these people had been students there just a year or two before I arrived, or maybe some of them even at the same time that I was there.
Yeah.
The connection, though, was I sort of have this other vivid memory of once sitting before a TM lecture that I was to give in Bismarck, North Dakota, reading Alan Watts' book, Cloud Hidden, Whereabouts Unknown. And somebody coming into the lecture looked at it and said, oh, you like Alan Watts? You like that book? Do you know Gary Snyder's work at all? And I didn't. I'd never heard the name. He said, you should look up a book called Earth Household. And that was probably the first New Directions book I ever had also. So, you know, they were smart and put all a list of all the New Directions titles. So it just opened everything. I mean, basically you have, there's a lifetime of study just in the New Directions backlist. But then it quickly went from there to other running mates of Snyder into the Beats and into certain Beat publishers like City Lights and Grove. So between the three of those publishers, I was set for 10 years, you know, of work, and still haven't finished that course of study. But
right. Well, a few of us do. So, but from I mean, that's like an education by reading in the kind of canon of literary publishing of the 20th century in America, which is kind of interesting. And you're the first book. Now, were you later then moved from Iowa City to Minneapolis? Yes?
By way of Naropa, Boulder.
Right. Oh, that's right. You went to Naropa.
I was out at Naropa as kind of an auditor. I was auditing at Naropa for a year and a half, hearing readings. And another thing that was key before leaving Iowa that we were talking about before we started recording was the Olson Festival. Yeah. And when you mentioned the link to, say, Black Mountain and Williams and people like that, one of my professors, Sherman Paul, was the host for the Olson Festival at Iowa in 1978 that brought in Robert Creeley, Ed Dorn, Robert Duncan. And it was a complete immersion. That event was an immersion, but also the courses that I was taking with him at that time into the probably simply stated the New American poetry, with a particular emphasis on the Olson crowd, the Olson influence, say.
Well, in Black Mountain. Clearly, you know, that he is most associated with. So from Naropa, then, and that's when it was in Boulder where you first got involved in bookselling?
That's when I was in the mode of book buying then, and I was eventually going to have a store. I didn't know where or when, but I was buying like a madman, and continued to do so for a number of years. And then we got up to Minneapolis and continued buying there, and then finally opened a small bookstore in a residential neighborhood in South Minneapolis called Origin Books.
Right, named after Sid Corman's magazine.
Exactly.
Did you ever talk to Sid about that?
I didn't. You know, this is pre-internet, so I had no idea that he was even alive at that point. This was all deep history, right? So I did get a letter from someone who was a friend of his in Massachusetts asking, what is Origin Books that I hear about? So, but he was assured that it was friendly and it was all right. So,
right. And, you know, you can't really trade on a name like that anyway, but.
No, but very few people recognize the reference point.
Right. Yeah, you'd have to be somewhat literary in the first place. So and then how long did you stay in Minnesota?
I was there kind of through the 80s. We arrived in around basically the end of 79, and I left and moved to New York at the end of 88.
So what prompted you to come to New York?
Well, what really prompted me to come here was I loved New York, you know, after I visited. I always wanted to move to the Bay Area, and its history of book publishing and poets is, you know, is, as Larry Fagan said, it dominates, you know, it absolutely just dominates. And I had every intention of going there when the next move was going to happen. But after coming to New York to do a one-week course at Columbia in the Rare Book School, I was so blown away by the city that I forgot about the Bay Area and made plans to move here as soon as possible.
And you came at that time, you'd started publishing?
Just barely.
Yeah.
Just barely. We had the little shop, and I had a partner then, Merce Dosdale. We split up. I bought out her portion of Origin. And by then, by the time we were leaving, I was leaving Minneapolis, we had purchased Granary Books, which was, you may recall, it was a shelf of books in Jim Sitter's office in Bookslinger.
Jim Sitter, a bookslinger who took over truck distribution service for me back in 1979. And he had done Granary Books as limited editions of like broadsides. And some of it was in connection with Walker Art Center. The reading series there, because that was something he was continuing that I had started doing, which was broadsides connected
Book
to
Bookslinger
the
Editions was the imprint that he used.
Right.
That was Bookslinger, right? That wasn't Granary. That
I'm
was
not Bookslinger. Sure.
No, it was Bookslinger Editions.
So
there was
a
difference.
What was the difference between Bookslinger and Granary?
Well, the real difference was the Bookslinger was a nonprofit organization, and Granary and another little business Jim had called the Phoenician. Granary was his fine and limited edition business, and the Phoenician was a rare book business. Mm. They weren't incorporated or nonprofits.
Right.
They were just little side interests.
Right. So you bought Granary.
We bought Granary.
From Jim.
From Jim.
As a, at that time, to be a publisher or to be a—
Distributor.
Distributor.
Yeah, we were distributing fine press books from people like Harry Duncan. Abattoir Editions
was one of— Perishable Press and—
Perishable, to some extent, Beeler Press. The Whittington Press was a big client that Jim established. So we bought his back stock.
Whittington was in England.
In England,
yes,
yeah.
I remember that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He had a fairly, you know, impressive list of representing British fine presses. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of a moment in American publishing, where there was a little renaissance in fine letterpress bookmaking.
Right. Red Osier was going.
Red Osier was
Black
going
Mesa
strong.
Black Mesa was starting.
Yep.
There. Yeah, no, it was, I think the influence of, particularly of Walter Hamady and Duncan.
And Duncan.
I think spawned a lot of these fine literary presses who had a following. I mean, what was happening was libraries were collecting them, which gave them a regular— a regular customer base.
Right. There were subscribers to the press. And that was traditionally the way the books had been sold over the years. It really came out of the British fine press tradition.
Although the British fine press tradition and many others, and there were others in America too, like John Judson, but a lot of those, I think, and I think this was pointed out in Kyle Schlesinger's piece about you, they often would go, they would publish fairly established, acceptably mainstream writers in order to be sure of selling them so that the collectors would not be scared off by the content. You know, they would recognize the name of the author. It would be a kind of collectible. What you were doing and what a lot of the other American presses started to do, I think, was really break that mold and go into book arts as we now know it, which is to establish the writing and the creation in book form were equally creative and might be equally unknown.
That's true. That's true. Some of that came from Hamady. He was experimenting a lot with paper making and binding structures and bringing in poets that were not mainstream, particularly early on. He was publishing Robert Duncan, Robert Creeley, Paul Blackburn.
At a time when they were not famous.
They were not particularly famous. Right. They certainly wouldn't have been that which attracted librarians to subscribe to a small press. The same thing was going on the West Coast. There were a lot of interesting people going
Oyez
on.
Oyez Press.
Oyez was one. Wesley Tanner, Arif Press. Right. And
Johanna Drucker was publishing.
She was self-publishing for the most part, using the book form as an expression for her own writing. And
Eileen Callahan.
Eileen Callahan. Yeah. She was one of the Five Trees.
Five Trees.
If you remember them.
Cheryl Miller.
Cheryl Miller. Yep. Jamie
These
Robles.
Are all people from the past.
Yeah, really. I know.
Although some of them are not entirely in the past. Just for me in the past.
In your past. In
my past. But they're still around.
Yep, they are. Betsy Davids.
Yeah.
Rebus Press.
Yeah.
Jim had examples of a lot of this work in Granary at that time. Right. And so
was that inspirational to you?
It was interesting. It wasn't what I found most interesting in small presses. What first took me to Bookslinger was their basic inventory of, you know, small press books.
So more the content
than
the form.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And then this was there, and it was interesting because he selected things that related to what was in the main warehouse. There were a lot of writers that you couldn't help but be interested in. So and it also seemed to provide Merce and I with a way to enter the book business in perhaps a more viable way than what we'd done already at Origin, which was not financially going to work. And so taking on an ongoing business, even though it was an extremely small business, he had created important relationships with a lot of people that were well-known in the field. And their mailing lists, their subscriber lists, you know, kind of opened up possibilities all at once rather than having to do it one step at a time. You know, we kind of made a little leap there.
Right.
So we added a lot of presses from around the world. I think at one point we had close to 200 presses that we were representing on some level. I mean, we might have only had two or three books from them. But
ultimately it made you the primary collector and source.
We were a big source for that kind of material. And we traveled with it and visited libraries and bookstores and made a real effort to find a wider audience for it.
Did you find that most of your customers were libraries, or did it include a lot of individual collectors as well?
There were some individual collectors. Mostly there were residue from say, Harry Duncan's mailing list and things like that. So it didn't particularly overlap what I was heading toward, what I was most interested in. So with the move to New York came a gradual pulling back on the distribution side of things and moving forward on publishing. In Minneapolis, it published a book by Paul Metcalf, co-published with Charles Alexander. You mentioned earlier Chax Press. We did a Jonathan Williams book, Aposiopices, that was printed by a local letterpress printer, Phil Gallo.
Another someone who I have a relationship with.
He's still around?
Yeah. Still playing pool?
I bet he is, no doubt, yeah. And then the third book was the Jane Brackage book. That was also in process when I made the move to New York. We had the book party for that here in New York.
When you came to New York, did you establish a kind of retail gallery space right away? Or
yeah, it was upstairs, something you can do here. You don't have to be on the ground floor. So we were on the 10th or 11th floor at 636 Broadway, corner of Bleecker and Broadway.
Right.
And people came up, you know. The stuff was all on shelves. You could see a lot of material that you wouldn't want everyone handling. You couldn't have out on the street, but you could definitely have out up there.
So did you have regular hours, or was it more, it wasn't by appointment? So
I think we had regular hours. Yeah. I was working with David Abel then, and we basically were there, and people would maybe call if they wanted to be sure, but I think we had regular
hours. So I always wondered when, you know, about that kind of combination of public space and publishing. You know, the word publish, the root of it is to make public. And, it, you know, in former times, booksellers were often publishers. Publishers were often booksellers.
Right.
But we rarely see that anymore. Yeah. And you were doing that. And but I've often wondered about the sort of complexities of that, you know, that the work of creating is kind of head down and the work of selling is head up. And it always has seemed difficult to do both, you know, for a lot of people. Sometimes they have two people, you know, there's the person who makes everything and then there's the partner who sells it. But really, you've done both.
Well, I wasn't printing.
I know you don't
myself.
Physically print, but you are supervising your publisher. You have to look at proof. You have to just tell the printer how to print. You know, you have to design and lead.
By the time that really got going strongly, I pulled back on the open hours end of thing. There was a stint of maybe 5 years when I moved from 636 Broadway to 568 and had a decidedly public space with regular open hours, regular exhibitions, a full roster of public events.
Readings,
book parties, music.
Right.
A lot of things went on there for a while, and then it was done because I was really getting into publishing and I simply couldn't do both.
Right. So, well, that kind of answers my question.
And didn't really want to at that point. I was ready to really identify as a publisher and put everything into that.
So when was that roughly?
That would have been about 94, 95,
so I'd say. That kind of would mark the period that you would consider to be the most, you know, the kind of active period of that connects to today when you've...
Yeah, I'd say so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although there have been a lot of other things that happened along the way that took me back into bookselling and getting into archives and things like that. But it all related in some very specific way to publishing.
So, yeah, talk about the archive stuff. I mean, I know you've acted as the agent to sell archives of writers, of organizations, you know, some of which, you know, are pretty well known, like the Poetry Project and Woodland Pattern in Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
Some pretty interesting writers. You know, you had, you had the Brautigan material and you had Don Byrd's collection.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, was that an evolution of being involved in so many kind of materials as well as being connected to writers? I mean, how did that...
Yeah, one thing that was very significant that kind of propels this whole engine, you know, of Granary is the relationship to librarians. That started right on day one with Granary,
right.
And it continued to provide an outlet for my publishing all the way through until right now. I have my own subscribers, just like Harry Duncan did. Without that, I couldn't do what I do.
So are the selling to libraries for you as a publisher?
As a publisher.
Is a core.
Yes. But that also meant that I could sell other things to those librarians.
Well, you have relationships.
I already have
relationships.
They're
not just customers.
Right.
I mean, because that's important.
Yeah.
You know, most publishers sell books to libraries, but most publishers sell them through intermediaries. Baker & Taylor or Ingram or Franklin or whoever it is.
Right.
The publisher knows and values libraries, but doesn't have... Mm-hmm. True relationship. I mean, they do. I mean, they'll go to ALA and they'll meet librarians, but it's not the same.
Not the same. And also the librarians I'm dealing with aren't the standards acquisitions librarians or selectors, as they're sometimes called. I'm dealing with special collections librarians. Rare book librarians.
Although your books, I mean, you to be fair, you see yourself as both you are a trade publisher in many respects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've done... about 50-50
in
terms of the total output of close to 180 books.
Right. But the librarians in special collections will buy all of your limited editions.
Right.
And that, of course, enters you, it enables you to have conversations with them about collections.
And if you I look at the list of people that I published, and that is a guide to the people whose archives I've sold.
Right.
It wasn't intentional; it happened by accident.
Right. But it's a valuable service too.
It's
to the
everyone involved.
I mean, you have lots of I've known a lot of poets. Most of them don't have any money. And when they sell, if by accident they accumulate an archive of some value, mm-hmm. it can be, it's like retirement.
Yeah.
It's what enables you to continue to live and you know, not be completely impoverished. So it's
That's
a really
right.
valuable service.
Yeah.
I mean, in the case of Jonathan Williams, his deal with SUNY Buffalo, with Bob Bertolf,
right.
really supported him and the press for mm-hmm. a number of years.
Yeah. Right.
And it was meant to do that.
Right, exactly. And so I just happened to be there at that time. I knew the librarians and I knew a lot of writers, so I could do that.
Does that still happen?
Absolutely.
This is like a regular part of your work.
Regular part of my work,
yeah. So would you say, so how many books do you publish at any given time in a year? What is the norm?
The norm, my peak year was the year 2001. I did 28 titles.
That's a lot of books.
For one person. Half limited edition and half trade books. And we had so many book parties scheduled in the fall of 2001, if you remember was going on that
year.
Not
a good time.
And then I've scaled way back. Now I'm trying to keep it to around maybe two or three books a year. And I'm trying to not do any trade books.
Right,
at all.
The books that you... for anybody who's not made complicated handmade books, it's a lot of labor, even if you're not the one actually doing the printing. I mean, we're talking about mm-hmm. books that have unusual surfaces and materials, and you have to make a lot of choices
yeah.
and work
mm-hmm.
pretty closely with
yeah.
the actual printer. So it's very laborious. And so 28 books, even if 14 of those were...
Tell you the truth, I think the trade books are way more laborious than, I mean, there's a lot of labor by somebody in the limiteds, but right. it isn't really me. The guy, you know, on the Vandercook, you know, they're the one doing the labor, but try to put together a complicated 500-page scholarly book with a lot of footnotes and index, you know, I mean, you know, it gets out of hand. I feel like I've done what I want to do in the trade publishing. And I'm eager to pursue other methods of making information available of the type that I'm interested in making available. I wanted to say, because I was reminded of one of my favorite quotes from our friend Jonathan Williams. He said that that it's easier to give the books away. It's cheaper to give the books away than it is to sell them.
Right.
And so the last books that I've done that were in a trade mode, I've just given them away. I don't even put an ISBN on it. I do small poetry pamphlets mm-hmm. with people from time to time, and we just split the edition and hand them out to our friends.
Right.
It's much more satisfying than trying to break through to a market that I'm not even sure quite exists anymore for trade.
Thinking of that, I remember when Jonathan talked to me once about what it was like in the early 50s. And the way he sold books then was he put them in his car.
Yeah, he had a VW Bug.
And he drove around the country. He would print 300 copies of whatever it was. Now, you know, it varied. I know 300 mm-hmm. is not the number for all the books. But mm-hmm. he mm-hmm. saw it as 300 copies, drive around the country, find 300 people, and that's it. And late in his life, we shared the conversation. You know, it was like 50 years later. He said, you know, I've come full circle. It's really... I'm going to be doing the same thing. There are 300 people who want to buy these books.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not driving around anymore,
right.
but I'm finding the 300 people.
Right, yeah.
And I've sort of taken that to heart. I think in literary publishing, the perfect number of books to publish is 300.
Yeah.
And then you can either give them away or
somebody
might hand you a dollar or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
So I think that our
experiences
are...
There's an element of truth in all that. Yeah. And don't know what else to do with it, you know? I mean, the project, one of the favorite projects of mine that I worked on in the whole time I've been doing this was an exhibit at the New York Public Library called A Secret Location on the Lower East Side, which was an exhibit that tracing the history of primarily mimeographed books from around the East Village, the Poetry Project, and so forth, while tracing out a background of New American poetry to Black Mountain and to other venues around the country to show where all that work came from. I'd always wanted to follow that up with maybe a second volume because we put a lot of material in there, but we left out way more than we included. And just by nature of our mandate, you know, I always wanted to do a second volume, and we'd talked about doing another exhibit, something like that. It never happened. But in January, I launched a website called From a Secret Location, which started with all the content of the book and now is a platform for adding similar kinds of documentary material about all the proliferation of small presses that we didn't include.
The original concept, and I thought then how I felt it was impossible to do, that what you were laying out was just overwhelming to me because the amount of fugitive material, if you want to call it that, kind of it is.
It's fugitive. Yeah.
I mean, it's stuff that was produced by people at a time when they weren't thinking about its long-lastingness or what it might mean for history. So it's very hard to trace. Some of that stuff, you know, I see this in collections like yours and, you know, rare book dealers who have occasionally put together a grouping of, you know, here's the communications company or something.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and then I think, oh, my God, do you think just the stuff I have, which I picked up over the years and maybe – you know, is not representative or meaningful in any way. It's just an accidental collection of stuff I have, which is completely impossible to make sense of, you know, culturally. It just seemed really difficult to do. So I think the website idea is brilliant because it enables kind of an ongoing exhumation and presentation of so many different things.
Yeah.
The curation element is much less limited by physical space.
Correct. Correct. And the fixing of errors is
because you put it up and somebody writes to you and says, "Wait a minute, you got the year wrong. I did that in 1974."
Exactly. All that right. Or just the simple mistakes that you make in a complicated book that's filled with dates.
Right?
I mean, how can you not make mistakes? So it's it seems to It's got some longevity. I'm pretty excited about it, and I feel like it's kind of wide open. Like, I can do this for the rest of my life. You just keep plugging away at that, and probably will do so.
But, you also have developed a pretty powerful collection of objects that you've published, you know, I will call them books that have been, you know, where you've really established a kind of vocabulary of combination of book and, or of word and object, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So is that, I mean, that you're not going to give that up? That's going to keep on going?
If it does, I mean, sometimes I think I'm going to give it up, but I don't know really why I would, you know. It's just like, how do you know when you're really finished? This is a question for people that publish magazines. You know, what's the right duration for a magazine? If you're still doing like 100 and issue number 137.
Well, usually by then it's been passed on.
It's done. You know? Like I like it like a Caterpillar, 1 through 20. Right. It's like, wow, that's an amazing encyclopedia of information right there. And so,
well, but there are two different views among editors I've spoken to. One is you stop at a certain point because that defines the body of work. That would be Doug Messerly. Does not want to pass Sun and Moon Press on to anybody else. It reflects his interest.
Right, yeah.
When he stops, he stops.
Yeah, yeah.
And other people, it will move on to a new entity with someone else. But it sounds to me like you're more of the, the work is the evocation of your particular interests, and so you'll do it until you're not interested anymore.
I guess I don't. I hope it doesn't come down to that. No, and not interested anymore. But that some other more, maybe some more arbitrary thing, like, you know, you hit a certain number or a certain year, just kind of a reason, an outside reason to call it quits on the publishing.
Well, you could.
I could do that. Yeah. You know.
I think John Morton did that.
He did. And then somebody else kept up kind of the imprint, but
David Godin.
That's another story.
Yeah, it is another story. But it was, I think, for John, it was just, okay, it's time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was ready to stop.
And then he was back at the beginning again, right? He was editing Charles Bukowski
after
he sold the press. And that's really interesting how, and I feel that way too with this website, that I'm kind of back where I began. And what most interested me were the small presses and the magazines that were happening during that rich era of the 60s and all through the 70s. Yeah. So much stuff was going on.
Well, if you look back on it now, it's a pretty
extraordinary
period.
Yeah.
I mean, reflecting of the ability, the combination of available technology and really powerfully driven intellectual interest, artistic interest.
Yeah, yeah.
But today, you know, the equivalent is online, where the proliferation of online publishing is just beyond belief.
It's beyond belief.
And, and you know, think about what somebody might be thinking 30 or 40 or 50 years from now, looking back on today, it will be even harder.
Mm-hmm.
You know, imagine keeping track of what was being published in the 50s, 60s, 70s compared to what's being published today.
Mm-hmm.
Unimaginable. You'll need a machine
for
sure and a lot of AI to keep track of all this. I mean, the number of pages, it's just impossible.
Yeah, you're right. Absolutely.
So I don't, you know, for the people who are following us, I think it will be much harder. We have more fun.
We had more fun. Yeah. Stuff, you know, things, objects. You know.
Well, but objects will come. I mean, that's the other, I think the thing that also happens is that there's a reaction away from the digital toward the physical for people who are who want to re-experience the physical. That doesn't mean I think that anything is wrong with digital. It just means that it increases the value of physicality when you live in a digital world. And I think that is why there is a continued interest and maybe even a renewed interest in artisanal printing and publishing at the same time as the online experience just expands infinitely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. I think there is some of that, definitely some a resurgence again of small presses and little presses, micro presses, putting out things for smaller communities, more local communities. And
yeah, it just seems harder for those communities to communicate between themselves. You know, there we don't have the Granary Books, the Bookslinger, the
SPD is still hanging
except
on.
Except for SPD.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, there isn't a proliferation of the intermediaries either.
Well, it was a lot smaller world then, too. It was easier to grasp and be part of the national or even international world of small presses and little magazines. You know, I look at archives now, people that were doing a mimeograph magazine in the late 60s, early 70s, they all basically had, you know, roughly the same mailing list. They would just send it around to each other.
Right.
And you could kind of grasp, you know, You could grasp the whole thing, you know. You could kind of take it all in and absorb it. And I don't think it's possible to do that anymore. You would know more because you're more involved in it on a day to day basis than I am.
I feel like I can't keep up, so I wouldn't even be able to say.
And you've watched distribution explode, you know, and watched small presses, the whole, you know, kind of the drive to make small presses regular presses, right? A real, and that, I don't know if that did more harm than good. I'm not sure. Some of them might have were meant to be larger presses, but a lot of them were just small presses, you know?
That's true. Well, the institutionalization part of it is hard to judge. You know, it's been good and it probably has had some costs as well. You know, it kind of goes back to the thing you brought up a few minutes ago, that some things are, publishing could be like art. You know, it's a project.
Yeah.
It should start and end when the time comes. But once you become a nonprofit, you are much more likely to continue on with just the organization becoming self-perpetuating.
Yeah.
And that I don't think is necessarily valuable. Yeah. And in fact, I think Jargon is, again, a great example. When Jonathan died, Tom Meyer said, okay, you know, we're not going to continue to publish because Jargon was Jonathan. And so the Jargon Society, you know, doesn't
even
exist.
Though there were probably 10, 15 books waiting, you know, to be done. That were
inevitably.
Would think so, right?
Right.
Yeah.
He had many things that never got finished.
That never got finished.
Right. Jargon number X that still never got, but I know. But so, so do you, you know, you've done a lot of really important books. Do you feel like you've had your say on those, you know, the big books?
Maybe, yeah. I mean, I kind of do. I mean, I think a lot of that kind of energy I feel like really putting into the website and letting it come out that way. There's something wonderful and very satisfying and complete, you know, about having a book. But a book about this kind of material can never be finished.
Right.
So you're how do you satisfy the need to keep, it's a conundrum, you know. So
well, in a way, though, the website does it,
but you lack the nice feel of a complete book.
There
that's
is
not
no
done.
Corporeality of in
there's
it.
There's very
and
little.
I remember going to a conference once a few years ago about digital technology, and one of the editors in the audience raised her hand and said, "The way you're describing digital publishing, where you can continually republish, you know, continue to publish all the time.
It's always in print.
But there is never, when is the book finished? And the answer to that question is, in your case, never. Which is kind of beautiful.
Yeah,
but also counter to our expectations. So.
Yeah, that when will the book be done has always been sort of a motto of Granary to some extent. There's a little newspaper clipping that hangs on a vitrine that's what it says, and it's an unanswerable question, especially when we get into the digital realm. So I think there'll be some more books. I don't know what they are right now. I don't have anything planned that I can say is happening for sure. I think, unless I'm forgetting something.
So the answer is, when will the book be done?
Yeah.
And that may be never.
Yeah, right.
So,
yeah.
Well, thank you, Steve. I really appreciate your talking to me.
Pleasure.
This has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and the publishing industry, and I've been talking to Steve Clay from Granary Books.